You landed on The Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us every other week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm your host, Philip Marinello, joined by my friend and co-host, Trevor Aiken.
What's up, what's up?
Still getting used to this two-host deal here. No guest. Vince is still on sabbatical. It's learning the new thing here.
Me and you, buddy, just back to us, hanging out.
How's it going, man? You just got back from a birthday trip, huh?
Yeah, dude. Went camping. It was fun. It was fall, you know, like very fall in Texas.
That's probably perfect camping weather.
It was pretty great. The first night we went in, we got to the campsite after dark, and there was like, I was pulling a Pod People reference. This movie has more fog than the fog. And
I saw a VHS of that the other day in Half Price Books, and I almost got it just for nostalgia's sake.
In the woods, in a place we'd never been before, trying to find our way to the campsite in the dark with like all this mist and fog, and it felt very Blair Witchy. So
did Christina get your Pod People reference?
No, I don't know that anyone got my Pod People reference.
Well, if your two young daughters did, I'd be shocked.
No. Well, I also went with I went with a buddy from church and his wife. So
very nice.
Did not get it, I don't think.
Well, happy belated birthday.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate that. And great to be back for another substantive cinema here on The Substance.
That's true. The Substance. Here we are, a Christian variety show. Every other week now, we talk for about an hour or so about something related to Christianity, culture, and the arts. Sometimes we have great guests on. Previously substantive cinema guests include Josh Larson of Film Spotting, Alyssa Wilkinson, Brett McCracken, Tyler Huckabee, and Mike White from The Projection Booth. Other times we chop it up amongst ourselves like we're doing now. Sometimes we do long form, short form, books, films, but today, this episode, we're back to movies. We've been cranking on some really good movies this year.
I think we've done a lot.
This is probably 2023 at this point. We've done some really good movies here in the last half of this year. This year period. I've gone back and re-listened to some, but I was looking at my Letterboxd list that I made of substantive cinema episodes. We've been doing some really good films.
I feel like you've definitely got your wishes fulfilled as far as having a movie podcast, like really hitting some good movie stuff.
Yeah, we've been very Criterion film heavy in the last half of the year here. We did Double Indemnity, we did Night of the Living Dead, now we're doing Meituan.
Yeah, and Meituan is one that I remember I watched this a few months back getting ready for this episode. We've actually been kicking around the idea of doing this one for a while. We've talked about it for a while, been excited about it for a while, been prepped on it for a while. So it's nice to be able to actually be sitting down and talking about it.
And it's exciting for me that I got you excited about Meituan, a late 80s movie about labor unions in West Virginia from the Criterion Collection. I was like, I think Trevor might actually like this. And you latched onto it way more than I thought you would. So I'm excited to talk about this with you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, we always get into, as we do, reactions and things like that. As we get into it, but
I know you like stuff of substance, and this one this one's got a lot of themes. Like we talked about it, we'll probably at some point, I'm guessing next year, get into some more explicitly like union and labor rights type stuff. I was like, this might be a nice way in, and I was very excited how enthusiastic you were about that.
Yeah. And I guess a little background for the listeners too, like watching this film, it's on YouTube,
but it
not
does
like in on. A great way. It's not like Night of the Living Dead is on YouTube where you can kind of.
It doesn't even really look like you can rent or buy it digitally. You can only get it, I think, on Blu-ray or DVD, it looks like. Mm. Huh. Well, there you go.
So anyway, I'll say that like my viewing experience of the movie was suboptimal.
But we we will have this for a listener also.
Oh, so the listeners may have an opportunity to see this film that was not among my options.
Do you even have a Blu-ray player, though, to be fair? If I sent you a Blu-ray, would you even have a way to watch it?
No, unless you were sending me a PS5 along with it. Wait, does that have a...
I mean, we'd have to get a
disc drive. Wait, hold up. This is... does the PlayStation even have a disc drive PlayStation?
I think the PlayStation still does discs.
Telling you this day will come. I've been telling you this for years.
We would have to get a number of more monthly subscribers for me to send you a DVD and a PlayStation.
Not just any PlayStation.
I can send you a DVD or a Blu-ray. But
yeah, probably a Blu-ray player would be a lot more affordable, especially nowadays. I mean, who plays Blu-rays anymore?
Collectors and people who appreciate cinema, really.
It's probably about it. Yeah, the physical media. There's definitely like a type. There are people who are big time like physical media people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they usually have really good movie taste. It does look like there isn't a legit disc drive on the PS5. I'm looking at it now. Okay. So we're going to go ahead and settle that.
All we needed to get out of...
Probably already knew.
Sony home video game systems and back to Meituan here.
Anyway, all that to say, the viewing experience I had of Meituan was suboptimal. Crappy, glitchy, low-res recording of the film on YouTube. And so it was tough, man. It was tough to get some of the inspiring shots and acting and stuff like that I'm sure is there. And I'd love to hear some of your takes on that. That being said, like, it's one of those historical films that it's about this time in history that's so overlooked, so unknown, that even just the content itself, just engaging with the historical content itself, just kind of opens your eyes and wonder to like this entire period of time. And you're like, wow, what happened? I want to know more about that.
Yeah. That listeners who are unaware of the Meituan Massacre don't need to feel bad. My history with this film, I was completely unaware of the Meituan Massacre before this movie. I had a number of, I follow several comic book artists on Twitter. And I remember when Criterion released it a few years ago, a lot of the comic people I follow were talking about it. I guess a lot of them really love it. And just seeing some of the reviews come in on Letterboxd, I was like, okay, like this looks like a movie that I want to see. And looking at some of the stuff we were talking about going, I think this might be a nice way in for some folks. And yeah, I was, before a couple years ago, I had never heard of this ever.
Yeah.
So let me read the description here, and then we can kind of get into the movie. So
for sure.
Meituan came out in 1987, directed by John Sayles. Filmed in the coal country of West Virginia, Meituan celebrates labor organizing in the context of a 1920s work stoppage. Union organizer Joe Kenahan, a scab named Fewclose Johnson, and a sympathetic mayor and police chief heroically fight the power represented by a coal company and Meituan's vested interests so that justice and workers' rights need not take a backseat to squalid working conditions, exploitation, and the bottom line.
Nice. And quick definition on scab, for those who don't know, is what is called a person that a company hires to replace a striking worker. But yeah, crazy time in U.S. history. My response after the movie was like, let me go read a ton about that. And I remember just going on Wikipedia, reading tons of articles, watching other YouTube videos, like just really going fully down the rabbit hole of like this time and place, which I think I had first heard about. I'm trying to remember when I learned about this. You know, it's probably from some like podcast journey I went on.
When I heard about this, I did the YouTube and the podcast route. I'm like, I don't need to read a book on this right now.
I think I learned about this time in history from backstory about the history of socialism in America, but it could have been from something else too. Certainly, just a crazy time, but some really cool performances in the film and some interesting characters. Like you already mentioned, we've got James Earl Jones.
Vader himself.
Yes, indeed.
Chris Cooper was great. The lead was really good. And I really enjoyed the character of the sheriff.
Yeah, played by David Strathairn.
I'll also say, so spoilers, this movie came out in 1987. It was about historical stuff. I'll say I thought the guy who portrayed Hickey was not cool, but like very captivating and one of, I don't really get into this as much as I did when I was a young man, probably very healthy that that's the case, but one of the most satisfying cinematic deaths I've seen recently, where it's like, you really wanted this guy to get it. You really, really wanted him to go. And that was satisfying when he met his end.
Oh, yeah. Remind me how that one happened.
Yeah, no, that was at the end. Hickey was the main thug, the main heavy son by the in the clothesline.
Yes.
That was very good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that was...
My bloodthirstiness has gone down quite a bit since I was a young man, but when I heard that click, I was like, get him.
Well, it's such a desperate situation. It's all like very frustrating in a lot of ways, like just the whole thing, how it happens. I mean, obviously you don't want to see stuff go to violence, but you kind of have this like tense feeling this entire time that it's really going to end up there. Like it seems the total inhumanity of it and the total power and like show of force that seems to be the way the company is trying to resolve things just seems to lead towards that.
Watching it for me, it was really interesting because in some ways it has some of the familiar tropes cinematically of a Western where there are bad people putting pressure on a town to get their way, things like that. And there's a resistance and things like that. But this isn't just like a Western mythic fairy tale. This happened more or less. And the research and the specificity that went into this movie, actually filming it in West Virginia, they put a lot of, while it was very cinematic, it also very realistically represented. They put a lot of pain and effort to make sure that they were showing what happened. So while you go, oh, like this is kind of a Western fable, this is also more or less American history too.
Yeah.
So just seeing it through that lens, like bad guys coming to a town with guns to intimidate them is a very familiar cinematic trope in the Western genre. But this is our shared history.
Yeah. I was kind of curious, like thinking about this as a Criterion film, and yes, like there's the amazing history and stuff, and I know that we're going to get into that, but like when you view it as a film, like what makes it stand out to you, Philip? Like what makes you say like, yeah, this one belongs in the Criterion collection? Like this
that is a wonderful question. I appreciate that you asking me that, but yeah, no, for me, I would say it belongs in the Criterion collection. Absolutely. So Criterion's motto, let me look it up on the back of this Blu-ray that we're giving away here. Spoiler. The Criterion collection is dedicated to gathering the greatest films from around the world and publishing them in editions of the highest technical quality with supplemental features that enhance the appreciation of the art of film. So it's not just, it is great films and important films. Sometimes important can be a great term. Sometimes that can mean first films from notable directors, like their long lost first film. Like that is important.
Kind of like Night of the Living Dead.
Well, no, that's a very important movie in itself. I would say like Chris Nolan's first movie following that he cobbled together over several years of stealing shots on the weekends with friends around town. Like Following is not a top tier movie, but it's a pretty impressive achievement. And Chris Nolan now is so important cinematically that I feel like his first film has value and we can see, oh, this is the seed. This is the first film by this great director. So important films can be the great. I think Meitouan is a great film, but I think the importance of it absolutely
lies in the historical content.
Yeah, the historical value of sharing a story that is, like you said, like we both said, is not well known. I would have probably not have known about this if not for this movie. This is not something I ever heard about in history. This is not something that I'd seen previous movies or shows or comics about. Like, I didn't know about this. Like, a couple years ago, I think of when The Watchmen show came out, how everybody learned about the Tulsa massacre.
Yeah.
I think that it's, some could say unfortunate. In some ways it is unfortunate, but in other ways it's such a blessing for I would say the arts.
Well, entertainment movies in particular, yeah.
Yeah. Film and television has a power to engage the mind and the heart in ways that a history book might not. So,
well, it's kind of funny, like when we did Double Indemnity, right? And like Double Indemnity did really well. It got a radio show. Like
they did a radio adaptation.
But it's funny because like now, like movies are that thing that if you want to raise the profile of any event or any to get it out over the median of film, especially nowadays when things are so accessible through different streaming services, through YouTube, through whatever kind of thing that you want to subscribe to. You can even subscribe to the Criterion's own, you know,
Criterion channel is an incredible streaming platform. They have the special features and the commentaries. Like if you're a movie person,
this is not even your shout
out. It's phenomenal. But hey, no, Criterion Collection. If you wanna sponsor the show or fly me out to the closet, that'd be great.
Yeah, there you go. But ultimately, you know, that it is like you're saying, man, it's something that's amazing to have as a medium to really raise the profile of events and communicate history and stuff when information is maybe out there, but just not in forms that are as popular.
And I would also say, in addition to sharing the information of the events of what happened, a film or a television series can help you emotionally empathize with those characters, because you can read about that. But let's say, I mean, we've talked about this before, even if you're not like a hyper polarized like right winger, you can be like kind of in your own political social bubble being like, in my head, union's bad. And maybe because I'm told it, maybe because I have some arguments that may or may not have validity given the circumstance. But let's just say you're not warm to the idea of a union. Show somebody Meituan. This isn't a made up story, a fable to like warm you up to the idea of a union. No. This is what happened. This is the way workers were treated. Fellow Americans of past, like this is how our countrymen were treated by their employers, by their civic leaders, and ultimately like the federal government. It took them a long time to come to the aid of the worker, and you can show them something like that, and that kind of breaks through maybe political rhetoric and talking points. Art has that power, and in that way I would also say it's an important film.
Yeah, I think probably my favorite performance in this film was from Danny Radner, or the character Danny Radner, who was played by Will Oldham, who was the young preacher kid.
And he was great.
You know, just like you're saying, like we could talk about the different forces at work to kind of demonize and to harass workers, organizations, and what they are trying to do to try to really fight for their rights as free American citizens and as human beings, you know, to live.
Yeah, I would say that goes beyond. Yeah, that goes beyond some sort of idealized notion of what it means to be an American. Some of the stuff that was going on in the 20s, and I mean, it has a lot of unfortunate renaissance. Yeah,
yeah,
it has a lot of unfortunate resonance now as well. This is about the value of human life.
Yeah.
As well, it's not just an idealized like, oh, what kind of society do we want,
right?
But it's what do we owe each other, the base level of dignity, and what we can reasonably expect as a
as an image bearer, as a person of God, a person who is made in the image of God and is a human being who has dignity and value and should be treated a certain way. Yeah, I thought it was interesting, you know, the way Danny's character is used to kind of tell how the power of religion gets used as a tool in the hands of the company, in the hands of the state, to honestly twist the scriptures into a document that oppresses people, that silences their voices, that keeps them submissive and in line and under the power. But at the same time, Danny's character shows the potential for someone to listen to the words of Jesus, to see them as powerful and as radical as they are, and to call people into action with that. So it's just really interesting, right? You see both sides of it. I thought he played that off really well, and
his sermon of
excellent
the workers and the wages. I thought that was a perfect, like, writer's touch, where he was going in.
Certainly not exegetically sound, but neither were the ones on the other side at all, but just very fascinating. Yeah,
I don't think that John Sayles' idea was to have a perfect exposition of the scripture, but I think that regardless of his religious knowledge and affiliation, to make the point that the character of Jesus and the heart of scriptures that many claim to uphold and to cherish does not go in line with some of these things in the way that they were the way they were treating people.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was good to see that. It was good to see that represented, to see both the side of how the institution could be used to kind of, you know, demonize people who are organizing, to call it satanic, to call it, you know, all these terms that we see get thrown around.
I thought that was very interesting. Like, there's not a new playbook. No. We've joked, like, we're not a social justice podcast, and all these labels that have gotten thrown around. This is, it's not new. Like, oh, you're a communist. Oh, you're a Marxist. Oh, you're a socialist. And it's, there's no substance, only fear. And the lives of the folks in these towns were clearly, they were living under oppression. And what they were kind of being told, the lie they were being told, and maybe not even a lie entirely, is it's going to be harder for you to get out. So you might as well just make peace with your situation, be our servants, have this terrible quality of life, and just kind of just accept it.
It's going to be hard. Let's set the scene for people a little bit. So we're talking about 1920s.
Yeah, 1920s, West Virginia.
West Virginia coal mining town. And so you're literally talking about a place that's kind of remote, right? Cut off because
it's
of mountains.
Pretty much
because of
the mine, the main street, and the church.
Right.
There's like places to eat, places to sleep, and all the men work in the mine, or there's a couple of shops and a bar.
But
like,
at the same time, all of that stuff is owned by the company. Like, the company actually sets up the town,
infrastructure. They own literally
sets
everything.
Up the rail, like, all of it. And then these workers come, they live on company property. They work, obviously, on company property, but they go to bed at company property, right? Like, they buy their goods and their stores from the company store. They're paid.
So that was actually something that
script.
I didn't know about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned that recently doing some research into the movie. They only were allowed to shop in the company store
because they weren't paid in US dollars.
Yeah. If they tried to go buy goods and services elsewhere, they could have their livelihood terminated for, like, if you wanted to buy a shirt somewhere else, you could lose your job.
You know that
they literally owned every aspect of your life.
You know that old song from Tennessee Ernie Ford, right, Philip, about you take 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. You know that song?
No,
I owe
rings
my
a vague
soul
bell.
To the company store.
Oh, yeah.
That's why he says that. Because literally, like, you could go in debt, though, because the company store had complete, like, think about it, like, they had a complete monopoly over prices.
Like,
over
monopoly is like an understatement.
It's crazy. They literally owned every aspect of this person's life. So the house that you leased from the company. The money you made,
clothes, your tools,
you got
your food
from the company and was owned by the company. Like, the money only was good towards stuff that you bought from the company.
Your wash basin and bath was the company's,
from
and
the
you
company.
Paid them for use of it.
Yeah. like, so literally everything. So literally they could put you in debt to them even while you worked for them. Like, it literally is.
To work for them is to be owned by them.
Exactly. In a lot of ways, it was a modern form of slavery.
Oh, yeah.
Under the guise of contract employment.
Huh.
And so.
Interesting.
Yeah. And what's interesting, too, is what happens to them, right? So, like, if anybody gets found out as a union sympathizer, even.
Right? If you even just go to a meeting to kind of find out what it's about. Yeah.
Or you're seen around town with someone who might be talking to you about union stuff. And that it's like, okay, here's a known union guy. And the coal company hired this detective company, Baldwin Feltz? Detective, yeah, the Baldwin Feltz Detective Agency, and they would do stuff like they had plants, you know, of people who seemed like they were just other coal miners, but they were actually working for the coal company to, like, rat out unionizers. And when you were found out as sympathetic, it also, it's not like any of this thing goes to trial. If the company doesn't like you for whatever reason, even if they're wrong, even if you're not a union sympathizer, if you just happen to, for whatever reason, that ends up on the company's radar, you get fired immediately. You lose your house immediately. All the income you've ever earned from doing your job is worthless. Yeah,
it's not like you can have savings.
Yeah, everything about your life ends. And so when the town actually goes to unionize, you see this later in the film, they lose the entire town, and that's why they send the Baldwin Feltz detectives in to evict all these people. And they're unsuccessful at first, later they literally, it creates an overnight refugee camp of American people who no longer have this company town to live in, and they're just out here in the middle of nowhere with nothing,
literally just like farming and hunting and living in tents.
Yeah, and somewhat on the mercy of other mountain men who are just in West Virginia, kind of like a wild force in a way. Like, it's.
How about that scene where the Baldwin guys came to their little tent town and tried to steal? They tried to take everything from the tent town.
Yeah. They're saying, well, obviously all these provisions are here. The company.
Like, where else would you have gotten these?
We're here to take them all back. And, you know, there's some intervention there. Almost fantasy-like, where these guys come down out of the mountains like the orcs or the elves or something of
like kind of crazed, like mythical Civil War refugees guys.
Well, interesting that you mentioned the Civil War too. I mean, this leads to ultimately, I was doing some reading about what happens afterwards, and it actually led to the Battle of Blair Mountain, which was the largest armed uprising since the American Civil War.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast about that earlier.
So, I mean, pretty significant.
And this is over workers' rights. This isn't anything that you would traditionally think of as revolutionary. This is,
no.
I would like to have a normal amount of hours. I'd like to have a cap of hours. I would like to have safety regulations. Yeah. I would like to be able to own my own property.
Yeah.
Just stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
When the coal companies actually wouldn't and couldn't function without them, but they also, the way they were running it, the people necessarily had to essentially act like slaves for the machine to work.
Well, and what's interesting too, so like, speaking of that, and like, just that thing that you just said, where like they needed these people, but then they think that they don't, right? Like, they and they kind of try to prove it. You see in the beginning of the movie when they're bringing in few clothes and all of those people and train cars of black folks,
black folks and all the Italians in there.
Yeah. And so they're trying to break the union simply by bringing in other people. And you see another element that continues to this day, which is, if we divide these people by race and we get them fighting along racial lines, we can actually keep them from organizing in a way where there's any kind of political unity among them to be able to oppose our actual power over them.
Yeah, I wrote that quote down. I thought that And that might even be a good, I mean, I think there's some language in there, but I thought that that was a very moving, I mean, that was very clearly cinematic. I'm sure that was embellished somewhere. He gave his little monologue where James Earl Jones, his first entrance to the union meeting where he wanted to be a part of it. And he was met with some pretty strong resistance mm-hmm. because he was black.
Yeah.
Chris Cooper's character says, "You think this man is the enemy? This is a worker, and any union that keeps this man out isn't a union. It's a club."
Yeah.
Says, "They got you fighting all amongst yourselves, and you guys are the workers. They don't work, and you do work. It's not black or white or this city versus that city. It's really workers versus not workers. And if we're going to have any dignity and any progress, we're going to need to stick together."
Yeah. And so timely. Like, it's just such a timeless reality in American life that race is used as this kind of wedge to keep two different sides fighting along other things when there's so much common interests that would challenge people, other people in power's financial interests, right? Like the people who are tend to be the more powerful in society, the top of society, who are gaining a lot of the profit in society, right? They see people working across racial lines as a threat to their power and their financial interest. And so it's to their interest to sow that division, to allow that division to happen, to bring in all these other races and just allow the racial division to happen, right? And so just very fascinating. You feel it in the movie, like you just want these people to work together when you're watching it. And then it kind of becomes convicting. You turn it around, you're like, oh man, like, why can't we just work together today and figure stuff out?
No, and I think that seeing that in the film, how that worked, that's a lot more powerful than a lecture or an argument.
Exactly. Exactly. And then it's beautiful, right? When they have nothing, when they're in the tent camp and they're learning to all, like, the Italian
wives. There were some very good scenes. Yeah. The old white ladies trying to kind of make inroads to the Italian ladies.
Yeah. And showing, like, all the tension that is there, like, the way you raise your kids is different. The way that you do this is different. Like, I'm offended by this. Like, this is, but we're in this together, so let's overlook some of those things.
But we're both humans who need to eat and survive.
Yeah.
Like, we're both being hunted by these merciless guys who are seemingly, I was reading that in the 20s, some of these people were being paid salaries of sometimes 30,000 and up to do this, which is about $500,000 a year in our times, and expenses and weapons and all these things. Like,
wow,
they were paid very well to terrorize and to bust up unions and to really kind of squash any inkling of organization and uprising among the working class.
Well, I mean, you see that today. You have big companies that when, you know, local stores try to unionize, they spend tons of money, either replace all the workers, spend tons of money on training, shut down the location. I mean, stuff that should be illegal.
Here in Kansas City, the Starbucks in downtown, as soon as the union got together, they're like, all right, there's no more Starbucks on the plaza now.
Yeah.
That just happened a couple months ago here in Kansas City.
That was a great Starbucks. I mean, it's crazy.
It was like literally at the center of the plaza. They couldn't have had a better location. It was right next to the Apple store and all the shopping places.
Yeah.
And they're like, no more Starbucks there. I'm sure that was making them a ton of money, that location.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, I don't know if, like, we're ready to jump over to
no, I think we should do like a reflex on modern union. Oh, takeaways?
Yeah.
Let's talk just, were there any, because again, it was a historical depiction. Were there any scenes or performances or moments other than the preacher?
Well, I think like the climax of the film, right? Like, you have a familiar name in the police chief, Sid Hatfield.
Sure. And they even mentioned that, like you've heard of the Hatfields, right? Like, that was a notorious name at the time.
Right. And so it's interesting, right? He's the sheriff of this town. And what's really interesting is kind of how it all ends up. You've got all these detectives from the Baldwin Felts agency that kind of show up in town to enforce these evictions, to enforce all of this, like, really just depriving these people over the non-crime. I mean, the crime to the company of unionizing and organizing together.
And they weren't trying to destroy the coal mining companies. They weren't trying to, like, demand insane wages.
Yeah.
They were literally just advocating for themselves to have caps on hours and safe working environments.
Yeah. And so they show up on the train. And what's really interesting and different and kind of starts this whole thing is that a lot of times the police acted for the interests of the company. They didn't act for the interests of the people in the town that they are supposed to serve and represent and protect and all this kind of thing. They usually acted in interests of the company as enforcers against the people, which is another theme that has relevance. But
just a bit.
But Sid Hatfield was different in this moment where it's like he actually turns and he backs the people and ends up in this shootout. So, kind of fights back against this warrant, says it's bogus, and like backs it up and ends up, you know, being part of this kind of initial spark called the Meituan Massacre, which is the climax of the film.
I really appreciated the climactic battle. I don't know exactly what you call it, the gunfight in the street that erupted. I really appreciated how he shot it. And this was a wonderful movie. It didn't get all the props it deserved at the time, but it did get one Oscar nomination for cinematographer. The way it was shot, there's a lot of natural beauty in mm-hmm. West Virginia. And even some of the ugliness of like the coal mining town and some of the rundown, it's shot very beautifully. But I appreciated that the finale of the film, when everything erupts, it wasn't shot like some sort of choreographed action scene. It was really shown. It was very similar to, I thought of, The Thin Red Line, some of those battle scenes. It's chaotic and it's ugly and it's not glamorized in any way.
No. Yeah.
It kicks off by almost an execution style shooting and then just panic. Like once the first shots are fired, everybody's just going nuts. And some people are running around. I liked how they showed a couple people who were literally just frozen and firing in place until they ran out of ammunition just because they appeared to be terrified and they couldn't move. Then how some people were literally like going in circles in small areas just trying to shoot each other. Like it really captured the chaos of an urban war, like breaking out, and of civilians. Like none of these people, I mean, some of the detectives you would imagine have a maybe a military background. That's how they got into that line of work. But it is not a military engagement. These are just guys.
Yeah. Maybe some of them in their younger days had fought in the Civil War. You never know. But yeah, it's just folks. And this gun battle starts this larger movement that ends up in a massive battle. And what's interesting, I don't know if you know this, Phil, but Sid Hatfield later stood trial for this and a few other actions at the county court. And they actually moved the trial into an area that was controlled by the coal company and the Baldwin Phelps Detective Agency on purpose. They used political power to move the trial there.
Jeez.
No, when they moved the trial and knew the date of it.
I wonder what that verdict was.
Oh, the verdict was this. As Hatfield was coming up the steps unarmed with his wife.
Yes.
They had planted detectives from the Baldwin Phelps Agency who assassinated him on the steps.
That was the one in broad daylight. He was shot like 20 times or something like that.
Yes. And no one was brought to justice for that.
I started to watch a special feature and I didn't put together that they were talking about the guy who was portrayed there. Yeah, no.
So, I mean, and that's
a broad daylight assassination on the way to a trial.
Yes. And there's a lot of things there, like the company using its power, this assassination. No one's brought to justice for this, the killing of this guy. And everybody just kind of moves on with life. And there's themes like that, too, if for other political dissidents in America, you know, especially those who are representing minority populations, people who are black, right? They very similar to what happened to Fred Hampton. So you see a lot of these themes in the film. And then, you know, if you read on outside the film, which I think it almost encourages you to do, there's so much in this moment. It's such a good thing to direct attention to.
Yeah. And again, it's a lot easier to get away into this through a film than it would be, I would think, through a textbook or a series of lectures. Because, I mean, yeah, it's unambiguous here. Yeah. And it's not that commerce is bad. It's not that work is bad. It's not that in and of itself, the coal company is bad for trying to grow. But what is bad is the way that they are oppressing and harming
exploiting.
The very people that exploiting is the perfect word, because they are reaping in amazing profits while people are dying in mines or inhaling coal because they're working too long or all these sorts of things. And none of the people who are profiting are working.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Takeaways?
He wasn't that young. I didn't realize that Chris Cooper started acting so late. It was Chris Cooper's first movie, I found out. And I thought he was phenomenal from the jump. I don't know what his background and training is. The main union organizer, the main protagonist.
Yeah.
That was his first film.
Joe Kinahan.
No, I mean, my main takeaway is I'm grateful that I watched it. It's not one that I would watch all the time, but it's definitely one that I think is a good one to... Like, if I was a teacher, I would show this every year.
There you go. Yeah. And still an enjoyable film because of the performances and some of the depictions of the drama and the different aspects of it.
And I wouldn't say it was terribly salacious. Like, the violence wasn't over the top or grotesque.
No.
Like, if language or sex are really, like, super conscience points for you, there's zero. Almost no language and zero sexual content in it. Like, it's very much a dad movie or like a school safe movie.
Yeah, for sure.
It just deals with very mature things. I would also think
PG-13 rating.
Yeah, I didn't know they I would think it would be R just because of the maturity content, but like it wasn't overly graphic. The scene that I think back, and we didn't even talk about the one character, the kind of the actual Judas character of the movie, I thought his arc was interesting, and the real person he was based on, just total scumbag. But the scene with him and the men where the two young men were stealing the coal for the fire to keep warm.
Yeah.
And they were set a trap for him, and they're like, hey, one of the young guys got to hiding and the other one got caught.
Yes.
And they told him, hey, you need to give up some of your leaders and then we'll let you go. And then he finally gave him some names. Like, they beat him. They beat him really bad to try to get the names out of him. And then as soon as they got the names, they slit this kid's throat. And he was like 17.
Yeah.
And you're just like, man.
Did you catch that the names he gave them were folks that they had already killed too?
I did. Yeah. I did.
Yeah.
So they're like, this guy's good. But I don't know if the guy did it.
They were going to kill him anyway, for sure. Like, it was awful. It was brutal.
Yeah, the guy who actually did it, he's like, the guy who carried out the order of slicing this kid's throat open.
Yeah.
He didn't know. He didn't know what was going on.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And all this to protect a coal company.
Some coal profits. Just some coal profits. I mean, like, the company will exist. It's to protect their power over people. And I think that's, like, when I think about takeaways from this film, like, we've talked about this a lot in private, Philip, but, like, just even saying it here, I think this movie is an antidote in ways to the libertarian thought that our main problem, the main danger to the American Republic is the government, right? Like, people get this idea like, well, our government is the thing we really have to be worried about because, you know, we came from Europe where the governments turned despotic against the people and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah, well, that's not invalid, and there's ways to think about government despotism, but it's just not the only problem. And when you make government so anemic and so unable to respond to the actual political will of the people, and when you use it to enforce against the political organizing of the people, as was done in the scenes of this film, it becomes the lackey to private corporations that themselves are not this, like, the saviors. Like, we always think about, there's this narrative that's so popular in America that public and governmental bad, privately owned good.
Yeah.
And but the difference is, like, the privately owned stuff is not representative. There's no, the CEO does not care if you and all the workers on your floor get together and vote that, you know, this is what we want to have done instead. He's like, okay, that cool. Doesn't matter. My shareholders say this, and I want to do this, and I'm in charge. So the, like, look at Elon Musk and Twitter. Like, it doesn't matter that all the people who work at Twitter or all the people who, you know, the people who use Twitter think a certain thing. Yeah. If Elon wants to do it, that's what he's going to do. And if he wants to, you know, maybe run some random Twitter poll to think that he legitimizes it in some way, whatever.
That was so silly.
It's dumb. Like,
it's like the Twitter poll has spoken, and it's like, cool guy.
Yeah. Like, which you ran it in a fair way that people were informed about it. Like, no, like, it's, I didn't even know about it until after it's over. It's like, okay, this is not representative in any way. You're just you're trying to make it out like you're not just the owner of this thing doing what you can do as the rightful owner. It's not representative. And so that's what's so interesting is people, when you look at this movie, you see the danger that companies, that private companies actually pose to the American public. And that was a time that they lived through it, and they responded by organizing in the only ways that they could, which was unionizing. And it gives you that appreciation, that understanding that I feel like we don't, for whatever reason, is not part of the popular American narrative.
I will say, I guess then one of my takeaways, I was reading a Letterboxd review from a writer who I follow, and he talked about the American ideal and the rhetoric of all men are created equal and the American dream of stuff like that, how American society was not built on this, but how it's interesting that all this rhetoric was built into the founding documents and built into the myth that America has passed on to generation and generation. And it's interesting to see what happens when people who have swallowed the rhetoric bump up against the reality. And that's something that I think is very prescient, and I'm sure we'll talk more when we talk about these things in the more modern day. But I thought that was a really good insight. Because, like, we tell ourselves, right? Like, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all men are created equal. And if you look at brass tacks reality, that is not the way that things function.
Yeah. And I mean, even down to recently, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we just recently had a rail strike that was averted by a Congress vote, which is a thing that's interesting in and of itself, because for whatever reason, there's a law that disallows certain roles, especially regarding interstate commerce and transportation. It disallows them to strike if Congress steps in. It gives Congress the power to make the union strikes legal or illegal. And so Congress is able to kind of jump in and be this negotiator. In the middle of it, what they're asking for, what these rail workers today are asking for, is sick time. They just want paid sick time.
In an industry that I just saw today, by far popular industries, one of the highest profit margins, with about a 51% profit margin.
Yeah.
That's profit.
Owned
is at 51%. Like, what they charge and what they make. That's great. Like, usually if you have like 20-30% margins, you're doing well.
Yeah.
The railroad has over 50, and they're like fighting people on sick time.
Yeah. Yeah. This interesting part from this Guardian article.
Not an expert on this, but I
BNSF, who, I mean, we know people, Phil, who work for BNSF. Nice folks. I know a good Christian guy, a good Christian family. He works for BNSF and deals with all of this. And Union Pacific, the two largest railroad corporations in North America, both reported record profits in 2021. BNSF is owned by Warren Buffett, his Berkshire Hathaway conglomerate. And when Berkshire's stock price went up, Buffett its worth went up by $1.38 billion in a day when the price went up. And it's like, that's twice as much money as it would cost to guarantee 15 paid sick days a year for all these rail workers. And so it's just crazy, you know, like they're making all this profit. And then it goes to Congress to be able to break the vote, which is a crazy thing that exists in and of itself. And then
when you have that vote, kind of money, you can really make the rules.
And the Democrats tried to put through the vote for the paid rail time, the paid sick time, but it failed. And it didn't perfectly fail along party lines. There was a lot of party line stuff. You actually had some interesting comments from folks even on the Republican side, like Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and even Josh Hawley, guys who were saying that, like, yeah, they supported the sick time, which might be one of those political realities of they knew it was dead anyway, so then they could grandstand however they wanted to. But then, you know, the interesting through line to Matewan is Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Very, yeah. Very famously a recipient of large donations from modern day coal companies, comes out against the paid sick time. So very interesting, lone
interesting.
Democrat senator dissenter on that one. So, yep, just these issues. What is it? If we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it.
This was almost exactly 100 years ago, and here we are.
We're still dealing with this stuff. And yeah, over some sick time that honestly, in the long run, could make the company money, right? In retention and some other things. Like,
well, yeah, I remember when Alan Noble, reading his book, like, it's kind of mercenary to talk about, like, the argument of companies treat your people better so that they'll be better vehicles for generating profit.
Right.
But also to appeal to the greed. It's like, guys, you would actually do better if you were more humane.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, you would also be just treating people better, which should be its own reward. But there it is. So check out Matewan.
Half substantive cinema, half reflex, but
yeah,
it's a good way into it, and it's not the easiest movie to see. You can watch.
How can we make it easier for him, Phil?
So we did this with Double Indemnity, and we're doing this with Matewan. Every now and then, the Criterion has a 50% off sale, and probably do this in the future too. Grab some of the titles that we've covered before and give them away. So I have in my hand right now, I know this is an audio medium that we're recording well in advance, but gotta
imagine Philip's hand listener.
It's a weird thing to say. You can leave that in there, I guess.
And the Blu-ray that is in it.
I've got a sealed Matewan director approved. I love the Criterion. You can see it there, Trev, on the camera. They even have the director's signature there on it.
Fancy. Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Director's commentary on it as well. Oh, which no good Blu-ray should come out without a director commentary, I think. The details will be on social media in the week, or maybe 2 weeks, I guess. Yeah, in the time where this is the freshest episode, there will be. You can check our Twitter, check our Instagram for an opportunity to win.
Nice. Yeah, I'm excited for this to get in the hands of somebody who wants to check this out and check out this.
Get like a viewing party with your friends, a substantive cinema party of Matewan.
There you go. Well,
shout outs?
Yeah, I think that brings us to shout outs. I'm interested in hearing what you got first.
So my shout out this time is a book somewhere between a novella and a short novel, I guess. Karen Swallow Pryor mentioned this a little while ago, and I shouted this out on Instagram. I know a number of our listeners, it looked like, picked this up and read this as well. This book came out last year, November of 2021. It came out. It's already won several awards. It's called Small Things Like These from Claire Keegan. The logline here on the book says, it's 1985 in a small Irish town. During the weeks leading up to Christmas, Bill Furlong, Matewan tie in here, a coal merchant and family man. So he sells coal to people to keep warm and for their fires. Bill Furlong, a coal merchant and family man, faces his busiest season. Early one morning while delivering an order to a local convent, Bill makes a discovery which forces him to confront both his past and the complicit silences of a town controlled by the church. So there's family, generational trauma and drama. There is religious hypocrisy. There's a lot in this very short book. I found it very moving. Like I said, it's about a little over 100 pages, or if you get the audiobook, it's about a 2-hour listen. So
nice.
I thought it was beautiful and kind of heartbreaking, but hopeful. It was everything I want in a book. And it's holiday theme. So small things like these, Claire Keegan, check it out.
Love it. Well, speaking of heartbreaking and hopeful, I'm going to need to tie in my shout out this week to my shout outs from a previous week, because it is indeed World Cup season. And that is my main intake recently. And as you may know, Philip, the U.S. men's national team were recently eliminated from the competition after a 3-1 drumming. Honestly, a 3-1 accidental goal, just absolute shellacking of the U.S. men's national team. And one of the hardest things about World Cup coverage in the United States is, as a young footballing nation, our coverage is just garbage sometimes. I'm listening to podcasts. I'm trying to find, like, obviously the Fox Sports coverage is much maligned, much panned. The people that they get on there, it just seems like they have no clue what they're talking about.
Sounds like me with movie podcasts. There's like 10,000 of them, but listen to plenty of them, but so many I listen to like 10 minutes. I'm like, these people have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, and I'll give you, like, for an example, on one of the broadcasts in the World Cup, they were talking about boots, right? Because U.S. or U.K. players call their cleats boots. And they're like, oh, does the American audience understand? Yes, we understand that when you say boots and you're we understand you're talking about the thing that's on their feet. That's easy. But then later they'll talk about, oh, yeah, they're really just lacking a number 9. No, that's the thing that you should be explaining to the American audience is, like, what is a number 9? What is a number 6? What do these numbers mean? Why are they numbered that way? Like, what does it mean that the U.S. doesn't have one? Why don't we have one?
Football, we mean soccer, guys.
Oh, dude, and then the whole, yeah, don't even get me started on the it's called soccer thing, which is shameful. It's just shameful. But anyway, after this whole debacle, you know, I'm listening to these podcasts. People are like, oh, yeah, I'd give them B+. You know, as far as Greg Berhalter, the coach's performance. And the thing is, when you watch what I saw on the pitch in the World Cup, you need a place that you can just commiserate. I can just tell you straight up, it was bad. It could have gone better. And what was bad about it wasn't that the guys did bad necessarily, but there was so much potential that seemed to get wasted in some ways. And just to process through it, and I found myself finding that voice to really hear, especially as they kind of process through it over a couple of days, in the Men in Blazers podcast. Men in Blazers podcast has been around for a long time. It's highly commercialized, and so a lot of times isn't the place I go to for like the most like on the ground takes.
I thought this is going to be another Total Soccer Show throwback.
It's usually the Total Soccer Show, but you know, and they're a good show. I miss Daryl Grove, who sadly passed away in 2021. I think he brought a lot to that show, and it's changed since then. And I really wasn't, they were still kind of even themselves bringing the optimism afterwards, and maybe that's their genuine take. But I think listening to Raj and Devo, like, it was just the way that they just talk about the opportunities and the cup and what went right and what went wrong and what we need to do going forward, just I think really expressed it well. And I think it's important as a nation to feel that hope and that heartbreak, to feel the hope of, like, we have talent. Like, we have, like, one of the things the manager said after the try, I know I'm going long on this one, but like, I'm still in the midst of all this.
It's all right. I'm feeling kind of silly for reading the back of the book description of my shout out. Go ahead.
One of the things Greg Berhalter said at the end is, like, we don't have a Memphis Depay, who's the initial goal scorer for Netherlands on the US and who's played in the Champions League, he goes on to say. And it's like, actually, we do. But we have somebody who's got twice as many appearances in Christian Pulisic in the Champions League as this guy. And it's like, you don't have that excuse anymore. We're not the underdog anymore. We can't just continually play the card of, oh, America's the underdog. Oh, America's the underdog. You know, so four more years. It's like, no, at a certain point, we need to hold ourselves accountable for how we did with the talent we actually had. And this was the first year since the MLS that we had a starting 11 that did not have an MLS player on it. These men came from European leagues. They were trained in European squads under talented managers. They're a really good young squad. We could have gone farther. And so there's that hope and that heartbreak. And I think it's important for America to feel that so we can hold our guys, hold U.S. soccer, hold Greg Berhalter to a higher standard. Because sometimes what you expect out of your team as a nation is what you get. And so podcasts like the Men in Blazers, hearing them kind of spread that message, talk through that, to talk with hope, but talk about it with realism, to not bring this kind of American swagger of, well, we just deserve it because we're American. But no, like actually to be hopeful and expect a lot out of the good talent that we do have, you know, in a kind way, but in a realistic way, I think is healthy and helpful for what we need going forward to actually get the results that we feel like we deserve as a nation.
Well, there you go.
So
Men in Blazers podcast.
Men in Blazers podcast. Listen to them on their after match take. Don't listen to Fox Sports or Alexi Lawless or good golly, all these crazy folks. Like
listen. Crazy soccer folks.
It's
crazy football folks.
Well, it's just, you know, it's all of these soft pedal takes that are just really not realistic to what's actually happening out there. So
boom, check it out. If you're interested in what do you call that? I don't know.
Football,
the world's game, the world's sport.
World sport. And you should be.
Well, cool.
Sports. The one thing I care about, like everybody thinks I'm a sports person. Everybody's telling me, what? Oh, I'm not into sports. I'm like, well, I'm not either. I just like one
sport. You are
sport.
Super not a sports guy.
I know. I literally like one thing. And like, that's the World Cup.
Yeah. And that's not even like an all the time thing for you.
No, it's not on like, I mean, all the time thing for anybody.
Podcast. Yeah. No, but I mean, not just World Cup, but I feel like you have been soccer-y before here and there. Like you go into soccer interest spurts, but yeah. The World Cup is, I mean, it's fun to watch.
It's always a high point. I'm still gonna be watching. There's a lot of good stuff. A lot of good stuff in the tournament. France is looking really great. If you enjoy soccer,
and the international
at all,
like the human and the international drama, and this, that's what I like the most, is like the stories of the individual and the cumulative team's journeys. That far and away is the most interesting thing to me.
Dude, on Saturday, England is going to play France. I mean, how classic is that?
Also, we're just kind of off the rails here in general.
Just way out in shout out land.
I don't imagine a whole lot of you, because you mentioned this earlier. I'm tying this way back to the beginning here. I don't imagine a ton of our listeners are Criterion Channel subscribers, but if you are, or you can get a sample. Trev, you might want to get a sample. This month, one of the December collections that's added to the channel. So they have collections every month too of, if you're interested in this thing, like last year they had three or four different noir packages that they put. This month in December, they have one called The Beautiful Game, 11 international football films. So they have 11 different movies about soccer, and it's all right in this little collection. There, so there's one. There's one specifically that I've added that I'm very excited about. It's a genre blending and bending satire, a high camp masterpiece that I had never heard of before that I'm very interested in watching.
Okay.
I'm planning on watching it this month.
All right. I would maybe check that out after the World Cup is over. I'm still riding that World Cup high.
All right. We are so off the rails here, so let's land this thing. Listeners, if you're a longtime listener, you know what it is. So I'll keep this part short and sweet here. If you're a longtime listener, you know that The Substance is committed to giving our show out for free. But if you're able to and interested, if The Substance adds value, If you enjoy listening to this, we would invite you and ask you to join us monthly in our Anchor link in the show notes. We don't use Patreon. We use Anchor, and you can sign up for $5 or $10 a month. Or if monthly support is not really something that works with your budget, which we totally understand, but you still want to throw us a little bit, you can do that on Cash App at $TheSubstancePod. And this is how we fund giveaways, fun stuff like that, our website. So if that is something that you value, let us know by hitting us up at $TheSubstancePod or at Anchor link in the show notes.
Two easy buttons you guys can hit also that are free to support The Substance. One is that 5-star rating. Just hit that 5th star on the right. And the other is that share button. It's a little box with the arrow coming out the top of it. And send it to a friend, somebody that would enjoy history. Send it to the history buff in your life.
So I just
enjoy hearing about this period of time.
Trev, did you see any of our Spotify Wrapped
I did.
Emails and
I did
info?
Just look at some of that.
It looks, we have
some sharing folks.
A lot of people who share The Substance
Thank
via
you.
Text message. And I was like, whoa, like the numbers for those of you who share
it.
The show with people, like, oh, like New Substance episode came out. Like, I don't know exactly what, like, I don't really text that many people and I promote the heck out of this show.
Yeah.
So I was like, we got people texting our show like crazy. The numbers were wild to me.
I mean, I text the show to some folks. That's probably the main way I share it.
And delighted.
Yeah, man.
By all the people texting episodes to each other. So thank you for doing that. And I'll say, if you listen to this show a lot and you haven't, subscribe or follow. It doesn't cost anything to subscribe.
True.
To just click, hey, like, follow The Substance. So when we get lots of listens to the show, and I was shocked at the number of actual people who follow the show. I don't know how much that helps us, but follow the show.
Love it. You can also send folks to our website at thesubstancepod.com. And if you want to interact with us, send us an email at thesubstancepod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I am your host, Trevor.
And I'm Philip.
And we will see you next time
on The Substance. I'm going to start the whole thing over. Sorry. Scratch
easy
it off.
Enough.
So my substance... My...
Give me some good...